Hey, this is Mark back again with another great episode of Finding Your Summit. And this week we've got Pete Turner. And Pete is, to me, an American war hero. He served in Bosnia, two tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he served as a spy. And so we go through this entire journey, what it was like to go in, befriend the different village elders, try to extract information, be in very dangerous situations, bombs being dropped and bullets flying past his head. And it's just an amazing story. And then what he had to overcome when he came back to the States. And of course, you know, when you're in those combat zones, you're dealing with a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, and what that was like when he landed and how he's overcome that and still dealing with that. So Pete Turner is the guy on the podcast this week. And always remember to rate, review, go to iTunes. It really helps if you do that. And if you want to find out any info about my climbs, about what's going on, about the upcoming or past episodes of my podcast, you can go to markpattisonnfl.com and check it all out. So with that note, let's talk to Pete. Hey, everybody, it's me, Mark Pattison, back again at my World HQ here with Pete Turner, who is an American war hero in my book, at least. And this guy has been in over 1,000 different missions in Bosnia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and it is an absolute joy and treat as we sit here and drink teas, English style, to have you here in Hermosa Beach. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. This is fantastic. This is, I love being able to tell these stories.
Oh, man, it's really rewarding, you know, for me. And I've had a couple guys now on. I was recently interviewing a guy named the Cap, Charles Plum, and he was a POW in Vietnam for 6 years. And just to sit here and listen to these crazy tales of just the adversity and that, you know, he was flying jets until he got shut down. But, you know, having people, all that just, you know, the intensity and the restlessness and then being tortured and shackled and all that stuff. And it's just insane. And you actually, you know, it wasn't just one. I mean, he was in Vietnam and he had a hard enough time. And then he was a POW for 6 years. But in your case, fortunately, you didn't get captured. But still, the issues that you guys had to go through all these different countries and all these different conflicts.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that?
Well, and let me just expand a little more. Understand, too, I live in this space between the combatants, right? So of course the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, whoever it is that's chasing and has targeted me. I mean, there's intel, kill Pete, you know, like that's actually a thing. But I've also got to satisfy my command, and I'm not telling them things they want to hear. I'm a bearer of bad news a lot of time. So when we go out into villages and go do things, create a well or whatever it's going to be, everybody who digs the well is like, we won today. We dug a well and people are happy. And then I go back and I'm like, tell me what happened today. And then they don't talk about the well, or show me where the government is. And I can't find a trace of the new government that we're standing up. I bring that news back. And if I don't have trust and influence with the command, it doesn't matter what I do. So I could get killed in the staff room just as fast as I mean, figuratively, but literally out in the field. So it's a two-way fight where I'm constantly having to create influence and trust with my own people and spend way more time dealing with and maintaining those relationships than I do outside, because we are our own worst enemy in these situations usually.
So I want to get into all this stuff, right? Because you just don't like show up and like, hey, Bosnia, here we go, right?
Yeah.
And so where did you grow up?
I grew up in the Bay Area, California.
Okay. And, you know, normal high school.
Normal.
All that kind of stuff. And so was it out of high school that you decided to sign up for the Army?
No, the story goes like this. I went off to college and I kind of bounced around because I guess I'm kind of a nomad, wanderlust kind of guy.
Yeah.
And I finally graduated. And I graduated in a time when the economy was downturned a little bit. And so it was tough to find a job. And so I was struggling, but I still had work. Like, I had a job at Costco. And so one day I was just getting told no and no and no over and over again. I got to do something different. I was in that problem. I had no experience, and every job required experience.
Right.
So where do you go to get experience?
Yeah.
So I'm like, I'm going to go join the Army.
Yeah.
And so I went down and I saw the recruiter and I said, you know, I don't want to be outside all the time. I don't want to be inside all the time. I don't want to have to do stuff that sucks. Yeah. But I don't want to be bored out of my mind because I don't do anything that ever sucks. And they're like, okay, yeah, take some tests. I test well. You should be a counterintelligence agent, a spy. And I'm like, well, that seems to fit, you know? And so I went from pushing carts in the rain to signing up to be a spy in the Army.
So my daughter right now, Amelia Pattison, is over here and she's filming this live. Hey, everybody out there. And we used to always watch this show called 24.
Sure.
Jack Bauer, right?
Yeah.
So now we're not talking about, you know, a spy necessarily in a foreign country, but everything was undercover, right? And now I'm also associating with James Bond, 007 type stuff. So how do you become a spy?
Yeah.
Have we just revealed your
secret?
Are you good?
No, yeah, I'm totally fine. Yeah, okay. Because, okay, first they have to understand there's a lot of different kinds of spies, right? There's guys that in place or test for bugs, right? There's guys that do lie detector testing and examining of clearance backgrounds. Those guys are in the spy world, right? You're countering spies by looking for them and trying to detect, does Mark need to have a clearance? That guy, in effect, is a spy. So in my case, so there's also tactical spies that are trying to do short-term, like impactful kind of work. And then there's strategic guys, you know, so when you see James Bond or Jack Bauer, they're sort of an amalgamation of a bunch of these things.
Yeah.
So in reality is that you're going to specialize in certain things. What I'm specialized in is going into conflict zones, out into town and finding people that will talk to me and tell me things that they wouldn't otherwise do.
So how do you train for that? Again, let's go back to, I want to go through each one of these because one of these places are so fascinating.
Yeah.
And so you go to high school, you're in and out of college, you finally decide to sign up for the Army, you test well, and then they decide that this would be the best path for you, right? So off you go, and you go get some training, right?
Yep.
And how do you, again, kind of the experience, but you don't have the experience, how to become a spy to go extract information and the trust of these different people?
Yeah.
If you haven't actually done that, and you're not talking about, you know, going down to Manhattan Beach and, you know, rolling up. I mean, this is intense fighting conflict.
For everybody, it's a different path because there isn't, you want to think in your head like the military's got this big design, but they don't. Their job is to get you through school, not to make you into a counterintelligence agent. So how do we get you through this singular path? So you go through the singular path and you emerge and you literally know nothing about the job, you know? And so you start self-developing. If you've got a good boss, they're trying to put you in positions to do things. But when I graduate and I go to Germany, which is where my first assignment was, there's no conflict to go to. So our day-to-day job is doing background investigations on people who work in Berlin and have access to nuclear codes. Like, okay, that person has to have a top secret clearance. Let's go reinvestigate because it's been a while since we talked to them. That was the main job that we had to do. And it turned out that I didn't even do that job, really. What I did was I worked in training. And so every now and then we would all come back from all over Germany and run exercises. And so I got the benefit of sitting at the table and being the mayor of Aschaffenburg, you know, and I would play these roles and watch how my peers who had experience would interact with me. And so I got to sort of have an experiential learning situation as a lower enlisted guy with people who had incredible skills, who had been to Desert Storm and these kinds of things. And so I started to slowly extract from them and just, you know, kind of self-mentor through a whole bunch of mentors, like read this book, ask these kinds of questions. And then it seemed like everywhere I went after that, there was a theme there with training. I mean, after Bosnia and I ran sources there, the Army on accident sent me to the place where they trained people to run sources. Well, that didn't happen because...
Well, what's sources?
That's when you find someone who's got placement and access to the information that you want outside in town. So in Bosnia, there's some Bosnian guy that I'm like, hey, help me out. And, you know, that's about all I can say about that. But that guy will now talk to me and I'll be able to ask questions or ask him to do certain things for me. Nothing crazy, but just give me information that we seek. And so.
Wait, I want to stay on that for a minute. So back with the whole Bosnia conflict, in my geography might be just a little bit up, but it was Croatia, Serbia, and we did not, Clinton was the president at the time. And I believe he decided not to send troops in, but we just like a barrage of aircraft to just pound, right? And to end this thing, which ultimately the strategy worked. And so if that's happening and you're on the ground, I mean, how does that all sort out? What kind of information were you trying to extract to?
Yeah. So, we sent over jets and attacked. We picked the side against the Serbs, right? Yep. And there's no right answer, so it's not about that. But we went there, and then what happened was is they signed a peace accord in Dayton. Like, we're going to stop fighting in this one particular region. That doesn't include Kosovo, Macedonia, none of the other former Yugoslavian areas. But just to this area, they said, we're not going to shoot each other anymore. We're going to sign this accord in Dayton, Ohio. And we're going to send in NATO troops, U.S. led, to ensure the peace. So we are going to kind of stand there and say, you guys have all committed. So while that's happening, we're looking for the munition dumps, the bombs, the nefarious elements that were, you know, doing things. I mean, atrocious things, you know, murdering children, killing, not only killing the enemy, but killing themselves to blame it on the enemy to stoke the fire, and all these things are going on. So we're trying to sort, that's my job, is to find the bombs, find the bad guys, and figure out who's trying to undermine the peace accord. And that's basically what I go there for. And so my job is to every day go out and talk to people. And I talk to farmers every day, but you can't talk to farmers and find this stuff out. You got to talk to enough farmers to go, oh, my cousin Ray, he's the guy you want to talk to because he knows people. And then you talk to Ray, and Ray puts you on to somebody else.
So are you giving them some kind of cash or, I mean, favors?
Yeah, right? For sure. I mean, that's part of what happens, you know, and I can't talk in specifics about that because then you're getting into a zone where, you know, it's classified stuff, not that anybody cares about it anymore. But yeah, you're trading things to get information.
Yeah.
Like when you deploy, typically no one's allowed to drink. A counterintelligence agent in Bosnia has to drink. So by regulation, not only am I allowed to drink, I'm given an amount of booze to use to spark the drinking.
Yeah.
You know, because you're trying to loosen the tongues.
Really create the connection.
Right, exactly. So every day I got drunk a lot.
Awesome, man.
Yeah, exactly. But you are in a combat zone, yeah, and you don't know what's going to happen. So you have to be like, it sounds great, but there's also a lot of responsibility that not everybody in the team can get drunk. You know, you have, it's a balancing act, and there's not enough resources. So you're always hoping that something doesn't go bad on this day. And fortunately, in our area, it turned out to be relatively safe, you know, but you don't.
Yeah, I mean, it would just seem like if two people are having a fight and then you're the third person to come in and be the moderator or, you know, settle it, you know, it's just going to be one of those things where you just don't know if somebody else is up on a rooftop and they're still pissed because the other side, you know, killed one of their friends or their mom or something that, you know, they're going to come at you. Yeah. Like you said, I mean, so are you wearing the armor? The body armor?
Yeah, you got body armor on. And at the time, it was more of like a paper-filled vest, more for like just slowing down debris as it came at you.
Yeah.
It wasn't really a bulletproof vest because that's what we had in that era. But yeah, you got a helmet on, you got the body armor on, and just your basic gear, rounds, and all that kind of stuff, for sure.
Well, I can't even imagine. So when you were there, were you ever in, and this is probably going to come further in these other other conflicts, but were you ever in harm's way where bullets are zinging over your head,
yeah,
and bombs are dropping near and you're just holding on, you know?
Yeah, not in Bosnia. That doesn't mean you're not in harm's way, because you certainly are, because you're not in control of harm. So there can absolutely, we went to a place where we thought there could be some very nefarious people a couple different times. And we had to have a lot of planning to be able to go into this zone because there's not help coming anytime soon. And by the time the help gets there, it's just to sort out the back end of the fight. It's not to save us. So you are in situations where you literally are so it's one thing to be the tip of the spear. It's one thing to not even be part of the spear and be in town.
Yeah.
Right. So you have to accept that. One of the things that happened where, this will illustrate this, I went up to a helicopter to go take overhead aerial shots of camps, because one of the things we did was like security assessments and stuff. And we had a problem in the helicopter, so we did what you would call an emergency landing, but not that exciting. Just like, we should land and assess. So we land and assess, and the helicopter pilot team, like, yeah, we're going to have to take this thing back. And we don't want to spend any more time in the air than we have to, so we're going to drop you at the helipad and go on our way and get back to camp and be safe. All very reasonable things. Well, there's no party to pick me up, and the helipad's 2 miles from the camp. So I'm Pete, one-man team now, solo patrol. And I've been briefed that there's 18 bazillion mines everywhere, so I don't know necessarily where to walk. I mean, there's a path, but you don't know what's there. You don't want to make a mistake that kills you. And there's literally no one else around. And I have no radio.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. You know, I was watching this show. A good buddy of mine turned me onto this new series on one of the channels. You know, it's like the National Geographic, and it's a war in Iraq, right? And so these guys are coming around the corner and going through one of these towns, and you know, it's there's people that don't look like they're friendly to Americans, right?
Yeah.
And just you just like you were talking about, they just don't know if they've got these landmines, you know, that you're going. So you're watching this truck go down the street, and you know, is this thing going to get blown out of the water,
right,
or you know, what's going to happen? And so that anticipation, I'm sure, as we talk more about this PTSD, just the anxiety of waking up, you know, and I'm sure you saw it with a lot of people, but just, you know, it's not just like a walk in the park. I mean, it's a walk in the park with a lot of elements, you know, going on.
It is. It's exactly right. So in this case, I surrounded myself with a bunch of kids and said, whoever decides to kill me is going to have to kill these kids too.
You know?
Right. But I mean, it's also, again, it's that balance of like, I don't have enough resources to do this. So I'm going to make this compromise. I'm going to bring these kids around me. And they didn't like trick them. They're interested in what I was doing, you know? And so I used my meager Serbo Crow skills and talked to them a little bit, and we walked and I got back to the camp safe. But there's a lot of damage in that, mental damage that it's tough to perceive when you're 25 years old.
Yeah.
You know, you just don't understand the, you know, the rubber band gets stretched tight and, you know, there's no resolution. It just stays stretched.
Yeah.
And then in my case, I just kept stretching and stretching and adding more rubber bands and pulling.
Yeah.
So it's, tension.
Yeah. So, you know, this is all about finding your summit and overcoming adversity. And so, you know, as we march through these different conflicts, like you said, that rubber band just gets tighter and tighter and tighter.
Right.
And then, you know, finally something pops, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So how many years were you in Bosnia?
It was basically like a 10-month deployment. You know, but don't think of time in terms of like a regular year, like every day you're grinding. You know, you're working a 16-hour day is a normal day for someone who's deployed and has a job like me, because I've got to pre-plan, I've got to execute, and then I've got to write reports. So if each of those things takes 4 hours, I haven't eaten, taken a shower, done anything else, you know, so you're going hard all the time. And if that execution phase lasts 10 hours, it lasts 10 hours. And so you work a ton, you know, you're having so many conversations and you're writing notes and it's furious and your brain is just cooking as you're trying to think through all the things you've got to think through.
And I can't imagine even, you know, like we're here on a Saturday, right? Yeah. So it's the weekend, right? So most people take the weekend off, right?
Right.
And I can't imagine like, hey, let's run down and get a burger and beer, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're not, you know, they're intense areas, so you got to watch yourself.
Right, yeah. And in some areas, they have that ability where you can take time and slow down, but that's not something that's ever been really afforded me, and not something I would want. Like, I'm good at war. You know, I need to be out in the front of the war and talking to people. That's where I can have my most impact. Like, I can do analysis, but not everybody can go and sit in a cafe and be in harm's way and think through all the questions you have to ask. Like, let me give you an example. I can read someone else's report and I can say, here's where you're losing track of the conversation. Here's where, you know, and I can read between the lines the questions they should have asked, but they don't have the presence to be calm in that moment. Now, granted, this happens later on. In this Bosnia, I'm cutting my teeth. I'm figuring it out. I'm having my 1,000 conversations you have to have to understand what the heck you might be doing. You know, so you talk about development. That's what Bosnia really was for me, was development, learning what it takes to do this job.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. So now you come back to the States, I presume, right? And where were you based out of?
Out of Germany, Frankfurt area.
Okay. So you come back to Germany.
Right.
And now could you get out at that point? Or
I still had some time left. So I went to Arizona, Fort Huachuca.
But by the way, what is the commitment when you first get in? What is the commitment?
I signed up for a 5-year active commitment, 8 years of total time.
Yeah.
So I'm committed to 5 years. And after that, we can pretty much decide what I want to do from there. So I'm still within that 5-year window. I go to Fort Huachuca, which is where they train everybody.
And where's that?
That's Arizona. That's basically Mexico.
Okay.
Really south central eastern area, like Tombstone. We're south of Tombstone.
So Millia's in Tucson.
An hour south of Tucson.
Tucson, Arizona. Yeah. Okay.
So we went there, and then I worked at the source course there. So again, every day, now I'm coaching and mentoring senior level people that are coming through this course. It's an advanced course, and I'm playing every day and again, drawing from them and then basically taking like, here's what does and doesn't work. Yeah. You know, because the doctrine is very strict. It's like with climbing mountains, like you know what you do and then you adapt what you know to what the mountain requires.
Right.
You know, like you can climb a mountain. That doesn't mean we talked about it on my show, what I did with you. You're not going to climb K2. Like that's, you know, like it's just not worth it.
Yeah.
So it's the same kind of thing where you're teaching people to find that path that's the right way up the mountain, because it's incredibly hard to get someone to trust you in these kind of situations.
Yeah.
So how do we get the trust?
Well, it's all the variables you're talking about, right?
Yeah.
And using that mountain climbing metaphor, it's really true. I mean, it's just the same mountain you could go up. you know, one day is a blizzard, you know, that whole into thin air thing, right? Yeah. That you with Everest and all those guys died, you know, I mean, I've had buddies that have climbed Mount Everest on a bluebird day and there was no issues outside of it was just very difficult. And then those guys decided to go in a superstorm. Right. And just like I'm sure that you're out there and some days it's calm and everybody's like, you know, everything's cool.
Yeah.
And then next thing, you know, all hell breaks loose.
Yeah.
You know, what do you do with that? So, no, it's really fascinating and it's interesting. Okay. So now you're back in Germany and you still have time. And now we enter into Iraq. And I think you had two tours, right?
Oh, I was there for a long time, years and years. Now, a lot of this time I'm out of the military. So when I was in Fort Huachuca, my boss said, hey, let's get you a master's degree and let's get out. Like, you are great at this, but this is going to drive you crazy.
Yeah.
And so she did the best favor for me. She's like, you don't need to be here. Come back. Don't come back, but just get out and go try other things for a while. So I did. And then I went to Chicago and got married, had a kid, my daughter, Brenna. She's awesome. And then a bunch of dudes flew some planes into some buildings. And at the time I was in the reserves. So I was the first, I stood up from my desk once we figured out what happened. We didn't even know it was terrorists yet. Just, I'm like, that's gotta be terrorism. So I went over to my boss and said, I gotta go do army stuff. And he's like, yeah, I know.
Yeah.
And so I left. I was the first guy in my unit, you know, and I stayed there for the next 20 some odd hours because we just did Chicago. We don't know. Were we next? We didn't know. Was there a plane already in the air coming? We just had no idea.
So where do you go?
I go over to the Great Lakes Naval Station over there where they still have a base, and there's a little pocket for Army people. And I just go there, and I'm ready to do whatever. And again, that's it may not seem like it, but that's the rubber band just continuing to be pulled tight because no one else from my office, the entire floor, no one else got up with a job to do that meant I have no idea what it means up to and including getting into a firefight, you know. So you get up and you go, and you sit there for 24 hours, and you wait. And most of it's just waiting. But that waiting all has a cost.
Well, then at that time, I think Bush was in the office. And so, you know, we did go to war with Iraq. And how soon after there was Bush 1 and Bush 2.
Right.
Right. So now this is after the Twin Towers. So that's Bush 2.
Bush 2. Yep.
Right. And so how long after the Twin Towers came down and we just, you know, we reset, we need to like figure out what's going on. And then we said, we're going.
Mm-hmm.
How long between when that happened and when you ended up back in Iraq in Iraq?
There's actually a skipping stone in between. So 9/11 happens, 10/11, I'm in the Mideast, I'm in Egypt, and I'm helping, how do I say this? There's like tours to go to the pyramids and things like that for soldiers while we're out doing exercises and being present in the region. And my job was to sort of oversee what happened. I didn't really have like a spying type job, but guys like Dr. Zawa, so you see on the History Channel all the time, he's the main Egyptologist out there. I had to talk to these guys and assess what's going on. Are our people safe? Are we a target right now when we go on these sightseeing trips? So yes, I'm sightseeing. And one of the things I always say is if you see me working, you'll swear I'm just goofing around. So I'm on a sightseeing trip, but I'm always like, my brain is doing other things. I'm having conversations and I'm looking for things all the time. So I was there. It ended up not having to stay very long, but I came back in November of 2001. And then shortly thereafter, I left Chicago, moved to California, tried to get away from all that stuff because I could sense I was getting drawn in because that's what I'm good at. But ultimately did. And, you know, I got drawn back in.
Yeah.
In 2003, got signed up to go back as a contract intel person because there's just not enough experienced assets to go handle this new mission. So I was back in Iraq in the early part of 2004 and was there when they hung those three contractors off the bridge. I was in Baghdad when that was happening and with orders to get in a car and drive north. So, you know, it's...
Well, what's Baghdad like?
Baghdad's a big city. It looks a lot like Mexico in places, you know, where you drive around and there's all these little small shops and everything.
Yep.
But there's billionaires. There's all kinds of different people that have tons of influence. So it's a world-class big city. But in this case, like you could drive around for days and have nothing bad happen. But you're not in control of when bad happens in Baghdad in that time. You just don't know.
Sure. So what was your role then in Iraq? So now you're over there. Mm-hmm. You're as a contractor.
Right.
Right. And obviously you must have been extracting more information. So how do you know where you go? Like you wake up and...
Yeah. So it's different depending on what they want you to do. They want... So there's a lot of legal things that have to happen. And what they want is the military people to be the front face for them to do all of the stuff that they're allowed to do legally. Because as a contract person, I'm not really allowed to easily to do it. but it's a conflict zone where they're shooting, so things happen that are weird. So my job basically is just to be available to help out, you know, and interview people that come on the camp, do whatever I can to make sure the Army people can go out. Here's the problem. The Army people have just been through training. So they're like me showing up in Germany. They have no idea what to do. And so they've got to cut their teeth in a live hot environment. And so it's really dangerous. When you talk to Iraqis in that era in 2004 in Mosul, where I was, those people died. And so when you talk to them, you have to understand, one, you were likely killing this person. Two, they are likely lying to you and if they want you to go kill someone else. So you've got a heavy ethical burden to do your job, do it well, and reduce the amount of harm you're doing in town. And it's very hard to even understand that as a junior person. And most of these people were junior.
So how did you get over that?
Well, I worked with higher level assets. You know, I satisfied the job that I wanted to do there that no one understood. I'm like, if you guys don't get it, I know what to do. I do what I always do. I go find the tier one guys. I go find the SEALs. I go find the special operators. And I say, I know you don't have enough resources. And the three of us here are really good at this. And in this case, I'm not the boss of this team. That's another buddy of mine. But we go over to the special operations camp where they're talking to the SEAL guy. And I'd been out of the game sort of for a while. And so I'm like, I'm not going to know anybody. You guys just got out of the Army, my two partners. What are we going to do? They're like, let's go over and see what happens. So we go over and the main guy over there is like, I know you, you're Pete. I went through that course and you were my instructor and you're fantastic. What do you guys want to do? And so that hooked us in and we had a bona fides to operate. And these guys took us and worked us hard, put us in environments to help.
What was the most intense situation, conflict?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if there's bombs were dropping, there's bullets whipping by, there's people that pull a gun on you. I don't know what that would be, but what was the most intense?
Let me frame it for you this way. Every night we got mortared and our little area where we lived was under the path of these mortars. And that doesn't even rank with the intensity of that happen. So any night, you don't know when, if the mortar might hit your room. You get to a point where you don't even go to the bunker because it doesn't matter because most of the time you don't make it anyhow. So you just kind of accept that those mortars could kill you. And you get to that level of comfort with something that lethal. I was driving in a car that got hit by a mortar. I mean, that's just blowed up as you could get, you know?
So what was that like?
Well, it was crazy because they're dropping the same mortars that they would always come down. They're dropping and my buddy and I, I'm driving the truck and we hear boom. Boom. And they're walking and your brain does the math and you're like, we're driving right towards where the next one, if there's a next one, is going to be. So we got as low as we could go, got going as fast as we could go. Everybody else is clearing out because there's people walking everywhere and it hit and boom, it blew out the back window. It shot metal through the car. There was all kinds of holes in it. And luckily both of us were all right.
Wow.
But again, that barely ranks because there's so much conflict, so many different ways of getting blown up and shot at. We got hit by a tank one night, an American tank. In our car. And on that, again, barely registers because you have bullets whiz by, you have big bombs go off.
So what is your mindset in all this? So I know you're there, you're doing your job, you're very good at it, but in terms of you know, it's just constantly coming. I mean, listen, when they light up fireworks, you know, at the pier the other night, right? I mean, just boom, 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 you know, sometimes, you know, just when I'm not used, right? It's just kind of makes you flinch.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine what that would be like. And I don't know if, you just get used to it is applicable here or you do, but you don't. And it just kind of keeps, you know, stretching that band that you're talking about.
There's an acceptance that you have to have, at least in my mind, in my game, what I do. A lot of people around me. So one time there were rockets coming into the airfield where we were at and everybody's diving to the ground and trying to run towards bunkers. But I already know, like, because I've been around this stuff, like those are nowhere near us. It's still within a quarter mile, but there's nothing I'm going to do about those things. So I'm not going to bother with laying down. I've got other things to do. So you reach a level of capacity where you accept one that you're not in control of your fate, which is a big thing. And that does not apply really in the States, not in the level that we're playing at. And then two, you also say, I know that I don't control when conflict comes, but when conflict comes, I'm already making the decision that at some point I will take a decisive action, whether it's killing everybody around me or saving a bullet for myself or whatever it's going to, you put yourself in that zone so that when you get to that point, if you do, you're not thinking of what your options are. You're like, this is the time right now when I go to kill everybody. You know, because that's the only way for me to for sure get out of here. Nobody ever gets into that zone in the States. So this is the world that you live in. Now, keep in mind, a lot of the people there on the camp aren't in that place. they're providing food, water, facilities. They don't have to be in that zone. They're not going to be in a situation where they're talking to, part of my job is to find the absolute worst humans on earth in that region, because that's who knows the things that I need to know. And so you have to accept that. You have to accept that you're not in control of your fate. You have to accept that you might have to do heinous, horrible things in that moment to survive, because the ethics right now on this table aren't the same.
No, I totally get that. But I guess, you know, just as at some point in time when all this, you know, the dust settled, so to speak, and it floats back down to earth, and now you're back in society, like all this stuff that has been built up.
Yeah.
It's just that natural mental reflex of just being, you know, you hear a car backfire and you flinch.
Yeah.
Or you hear the fireworks going off, right? And it just brings, you know, you break into a sweat or something. There's just, you know, the subconscious of that. And I don't know this, I'm just asking, you know, it just seemed like that, you know, enough of that over a period of time in these really intense situations, as you describe them, would just take a toll on people. And you see all these people that are coming back from these conflicts. And, you know, while the death count, or I don't know the exact term, but, you know, Americans have been killed in action, there's that number. And then there's this other number that's just like 10x of people who are psychologically damaged.
Right. Yeah.
And it takes, and you know, bad things, suicide, alcoholism.
Right.
You know, drugs, all kinds of stuff they get into, right? Just to help cope with what's going on. And I can't imagine that.
And let me just give you some clarity on the things that trigger us. You know, so it's called hypervigilance for a lot of us. And for me, for sure, it is. So I'm at Gabby Reese's house doing an interview for the Break It Down show, my podcast that I do. And my buddy and I are sitting there. We're in Malibu. You know, this is pretty safe.
Yeah.
And she's got a walled, like a cement wall that goes around the front of her house where the road is. And an RV drives up and stops. It stops because it's beautiful and they want to get out and take a picture in the turnout. My head turns 45 degrees and I'm laser focused because I don't know who's getting or what's getting out of that RV. And I don't know if this is the time when they decide to attack Gabby Reese and Laird Hamilton.
Right.
That's in no way reality. But my limbic brain, my blizzard brain goes, there's threat. And it shoots out cortisol and adrenaline. So it's not even, yes, it can be fireworks for sure, but it can be how a guy with a mustache and a tan picks up a phone and puts it next to his face. And I see that at the corner of my eye and I look and it's on. You know, that guy's absolutely harmless and is just on the phone and happened to be looking at me. But it's things like that that you live with because your brain is so geared to go, there's threat, there's threat, there's threat, that it manifests it. And then you might react to that threat that's not real. You create an alternate reality that's a lot more dangerous than it really is.
Yeah. No, well, you know, I don't know which one is worse. They probably are both equal. But last February, I was down in Tanzania climbing Kilimanjaro.
Right.
And when I was down there, part of the six, in addition to the six NFL guys that Chris Long had invited to go down there and build water wells for the Maasai people, there was also four Green Berets, and three of them, there was two amputees,
right,
and another guy who was blind, who said, you know, Ivan Castro. And, you know, I mean, Ivan was in the middle of the heat when one of these mortars went off, and the shrapnel came and ripped out his eyes, right? Yeah. And to have him climb that mountain, to have this gal, Kirsty Ennis, you know, go, and she was a gunner on a helicopter, the thing crashed, flipped over. And she's the first above the knee amputee. Basically, she hopped to the top of Kilimanjaro, which is insane.
Yeah.
Took us forever to get up there. But, you know, just the courage that these people have and the commitment, right, to what they're doing for the U.S. and for the world was just remarkable. Yeah. And then you put on top of that, on top of their injuries, you know, this mental capacity of these things that you're talking about, which, you know, is just, it's just remarkable, you know? And to me, you know, life is a lot about perspective. And, oh, I played in the NFL. Well, you know, big deal, really. I mean, when it compared to what you guys do for us, you know, to keep this country safe and to provide those freedoms that we have. So anyways, it's amazing. I want to move on to Afghanistan.
Sure.
Okay. So obviously I haven't been in these places, but Iraq, Afghanistan, what is Afghanistan like?
You know, in a lot of ways, it's the same thing where there's the people in general, and I'm being very unfair to characterize everybody, but this is sort of the best way to frame it for our purposes. They're like abused wives or abused kids. There's not a lot of trust. There's a lot of hand shyness to anything that we do. And I don't mean actual hand shyness, but like that's kind of the characteristic. So you have to handle the people in the same way. Like the country, a lot of my peers, a lot of my friends would say, oh, when you go, it's totally different. You're not going to understand what's going on. I know exactly what to do because I'm starting with the people on the ground. And for all of my conflict experience, the space where I get the most comfortable is even smaller, and it's in dealing with the non-lethal things that really matter. Like if we're going to be here and if we're going to expose ourselves to this harm and if we're going to provide help, let me find that help. Let me go out and see what actually works, figure out what matters. You know, like it's not some academy that we build. It's the governor saying, I need electricity in this office. Who's going to show up in the office if there's no electricity?
Yeah.
I can't promise people something when there's nothing here. So that's an even more dangerous space because now I'm in this conflict space and I know enough to know that's not good enough. I've got to get even deeper and carry less weapons, be more academic, and, you know, still roll around with, you know, guys with guns, but understand that every time I go out with them, it even further limits my ability to be the guy I need to be for that, for the people on the ground, because I've got to work quickly. So the difference for me is more about I had built a system that worked in Iraq and I wanted to test it in Afghanistan.
Yep.
The country's really for me, could you fill in the blank country, it doesn't matter. It's people in a conflict zone. I can work in that zone. That was really the difference, was I graduated myself from being a pro to being an expert when I went to Afghanistan.
Mm. And what's the terrain? What are the cities like?
Well, I was out in the country, so there's a main route that goes around the entire country. It's about the size of Texas. So imagine if you just drew a big circle around all the big cities. That's sort of what they do. And I'm off of that route and another mountain range over. So it's rugged. It's every size rock from pea gravel to 18-foot high boulders, you know, so it's really big and massive, you know, and you know this kind of terrain where you look and you realize that the mountain you're looking at is 20 miles away, but everything's so big, it may as well be right across the road.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's the same mountains, you know, like it's huge and you can hear for miles. So your space and time are kind of warped by that because the environment is so big and you're at, you know, 8,000, 10,000 feet all the time. So the terrain is as rugged and as hard to get around as you can. And you put 100 something pounds on your back every day. So it's just, you know, and you know what this is like, you know, I mean, when you get ready to go do Everest, you're going to have a lot of weight in your back and you go up and down the mountain a zillion times. Yep. That's us every day. And you're climbing over different ridges to create surprise in the middle of the night. And so you're going up and over and you can only move so fast. You know, one of the things we lose sight of in here is when you go on a combat patrol, you can only go so far because if you go past that, there is no help ever coming. You're going to all die if someone else chooses to kill you. So you can't get there and be out of breath, you know, and it doesn't matter who the weakest link is. That's where you work from. And so you get everybody over. If someone rolls their ankle, you're not going back. That person has to. So you have to go at a pace that everybody can manage.
Yep.
And
you're only as strong as your weakest link. Yeah. I say this all the time.
And the weakest link is not weak.
Yeah, no, I get it, but you can only go, right? You're going at their pace.
Yeah.
It is what it is.
Because someone's got to carry 5 gallons of water on top of everything else because you need to have enough water for everybody. So, yeah, so you move slow. It's that kind of terrain. It's just massive, rugged, hard to live in terrain.
Yeah. So, okay, so now you ultimately, you're back, you're here in the States. What has that re-entry meant to you? Been like for you?
It's been the biggest challenge of my life. You know, I came back and my relationship was over and had to deal with that, and that's always hard. But you go from being relevant.
And it was, well, hold on. So it was over because of the time spent away, or was over because of just, you know, this PTSD, hyper-intensive, whatever word you used?
Well, there's some of that. I mean, a lot of the American Sniper movie, those things happened to me. You know, I didn't go to a bar and not go directly home, but I stood on a beach and just stared out at the beach and was in a rage for no reason at all. My girlfriend going, what is going on? Why are you so angry? And I'm not mad at anybody. I just, you know, and it takes a while to get home even. So 3 days to travel home, 2 weeks to like go, oh yeah, I can relax. It's cool here. And then probably months before you just finally settle in and you're not anxious all the time, at least for me.
Yeah. No, I mean, this pod's about you and, you know, your story and you know, just that adversity. So how many, and maybe you just answer this by saying it's still going on, but, you know, from the time that you came back, when was the last time you were in Iraq?
Iraq, it's been since 2011.
And then what about Afghanistan?
2012.
Okay, so it's been 5, 6, 7 years since you've been back, right?
Yeah, it's been a while, yeah.
So how where are you in that process?
Well, you know, you're always trying to figure it out. So I've had to reinvent myself a couple of times because literally, unless I want to go work in that world somewhere, which I choose not to, and I think I've done enough, no one will hire me, right? So I would apply for jobs I was qualified for that I literally were written for me, you know, like dealing with multicultural groups and solving problems. I'm like, well, that's exactly what I did, but in an environment where people wanted to shoot me in the face.
Right.
So no one would hire me. And it, you just like, I went from being really impactful with my work to now I have to be a handyman. And I'm not handy at all, you know, but I had to become something. So you adapt and that causes further damage because now I'm like, I'm educated. I have experience. Oh, I have value. Worth.
Yeah. No, listen, I get it. This is very similar to what NFL players go through, professional athletes,
sure,
right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
You just, you know, you've been doing something since you're, you know, in my case, fourth grade, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, now I'm 29 and, you know, the car goes right off the cliff, right? And then what do you do? And you're there and you're just going, you know, and the whole self-worth. And so it's very similar.
Yeah.
Obviously we're not getting, you know, bolts, but just in terms of that gap of, you know, what's my purpose? Where am I going?
Right.
And I think that's what this whole thing is all about, and that's what this podcast is about, is really trying to, you know, talk to people who've gone through. I've gone through plenty of my own stuff and just really understanding that there is a plan out there, and it just takes people some time to go from that point to the next point to really figure it out. And you used a great word, reinvent. Mm-hmm. I've done the same thing. And it looks like you're doing amazing stuff now. You know, you've had to, you know, dig in to dig out, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And you've got this really cool podcast. Tell us about that.
The Break It Down show is the main thing that I do a number of podcasts, but it's the main one. It's the one where we get incredible guests. We've had you on. Actually is going up on Monday. That's kind of fun. But also we've had, I don't know, Stuart Copeland from The Police has been on my show.
Yeah.
But also Johnny Walker, who was my interpreter in Iraq. So I want to, my co-host, there's two of them. There's John and there's Mark. Mark's an actor here in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And we also.
What's his last name?
Mark Valley.
Okay.
And he was like a main guy on Boston Legal.
Yeah.
He's been the lead in a bunch of things. And so it's interesting because he's a West Point grad and this artisan. And then John is a private eye, but also a drummer. He's got this soul of music and everything. And I'm sort of like a mix of both of those things too. So we just have this great time having these shows. Sometimes it's a solo show. Sometimes it's the two of us talking, whichever combination. But we have incredible conversations. And, you know, for me, it's telling the stories of combat so we can understand what we're putting our people through and how to do that better.
Yep.
But it's also like, I want to talk to Nobel Prize winners. I don't dislike reality stars, but let's talk to the person that's inventing ways to change our lives for the better, who's understanding science. So you might find anything on our show where you might be an Iraqi interpreter and it might be a Nobel Peace Prize winner.
Yeah. You know, I think we share, you know, a common interest and love of what we're doing. I don't make money doing this. It costs me to do this and I love it. Right.
Yeah.
And I use the word lucky me in this, right? And some of the people I've done probably interviewed 45 people now. And I mean, a guy who is attacked by a shark and people who the POW, you know, I talked about, and I'm here talking with you, and I've got other war heroes that are on the, you know, on the schedule. And just, it's just amazing the amount of adversity that these people have come over. And then here's the great story. Here they are now.
Right.
And their success story.
Yeah.
And they're still finding their way. Right.
Right.
And it's just great to be on this side and listen to these different. I really feel like my life is being enriched.
I say that those exact words all the time. I do this first because it's enriching my life and I want to share that with people.
Yeah, no.
It's so incredible.
No, it's incredible. Okay, so it's called the Break It Down podcast, mm-hmm. and people can tune in. Where else can they find you?
Well, social media, Pete A. Turner on Twitter. I'm active on there. I'll talk to you for sure. Facebook, same thing. Pete A. Turner, breakitdownshow.com. We're easy. We love to talk to people. So, you know, we're always involved with that kind of thing. So it's not hard to find me. Pete A. Turner.
Sweet. And we will have that in the show notes, as cool. always. And so, all right, wrapping this thing up, Pete, so appreciate coming on the show. Fascinating. It's just amazing your journey, and you seem like you're on the right path. And I think, you know, I know I'm better for it. So appreciate it.
That's all my pleasure. Thank you very much. It's fun.
Awesome. Thank you. Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. If you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.